and gentlemen, we're going to get started on time. I realize we don't have a quorum at this point, but we'll try and train our committee members to come on time by starting on time. So we'll call a meeting officially to order when a quorum arrives, but in the meantime, we will get started with our presentation today. We have with us today the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and Ms. Tracy Hatch is going to do the presentation, and I will ask her to introduce herself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Hatch. I am the Deputy Commissioner, Chief Financial, and Chief Operating Officer for the Minnesota Department of Transportation.
Just one more thing, Ms. Hatch. Members, if you do have questions, please be recognized, and Ms. Hatch has agreed to be interrupted during her presentation. So thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's my pleasure to present to you some information, an overview, if you will, on capital projects that are taking place within MnDOT based on previous authorizations from this committee as well as the full body of the legislature. So moving forward, I'll start with the local bridge replacement program. In the presentation, primarily I will be speaking to the last 3 years, any appropriations that have come the last 3 years. I will show you a slide, and if you have these handouts, you'll see it in your packet as well, that will display all of the current open authorizations that we have. We had a $30 million bond authorization in 2012, a 12.3 as well as a 20.7, so a $33 million total investment in 2014. And all of those projects are, all of that funding is expected to be utilized fully on projects that do support the local bridge program. The local bridge program is an interesting program. It actually, we have quite a list of eligible bridges, and in order to get on the list, the local municipality or county, excuse me, must pass a resolution indicating their support for the bridge to be on the program, and any funding that would be necessary in order to match or achieve funding through this program. Funding is used to replace deficient local bridges and to do accelerated bridge construction. There's basically two ways that we primarily use this money. We like to leverage it to supplement other types of bridge replacement funding, such as federal aid, state aid, which would be the county state aid highway program, or the municipal state aid streets funding, as well as local township bridge funds. Federal funds that come to projects cover about 80% of the project, and we often use this funding here to provide that 20% match, particularly on large projects for which it would be cost prohibitive for a local municipality or county to fund that 20% match. The second way that we use these funds is we provide funds for bridges that have no other source of revenue. So, for example, a bridge that is not eligible for federal funds could receive 100% funding through this program. Currently, there are 1,760 structurally deficient or functionally obsolete local bridges with a sufficiency rating of 80 or less. The average cost to replace a bridge in 2014 was about $530,000. There are 143 local bridge projects eligible for the 2014 funding, as well as the general fund dollars that were spread throughout the state. The local bridge funds have leveraged about $81 million in federal, state aid, and local funds, as I mentioned a few minutes ago.
Ms. Hatch, could you describe the process of determining how the list, how the priority list is developed?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can tell you that there is a resolution that gets passed by the local municipality. They would submit their list to get to their project to get on the list. I believe they get put on the list in order of the resolution passage, although I believe that if there is a structural issue that would require it to be moved up farther on the list, that they're able to do that. This is not a solicitation program like our local road program is. This is a program that is there for the structurally deficient or functionally obsolete bridges on the local system. And many times these projects take a while to get through the resolution process on the part of the locals.
Thank you. So if it would be the local engineer that might put in a special request because he thinks his bridge is more deficient than someone else's, then does someone at the department then take a look at it, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know that there is an engineering analysis that is conducted, and I know that our local state aid office works very closely with every county on all of these projects, including the road projects as well as the bridge projects, to make sure that the bridges really do for replacement. I also know that they do look at the actual project itself. In some cases, in every case, we try to minimize the number of bridges that have to be replaced. So in some cases, they look to close down a road or a bridge if we don't have funds to replace it and there's a suitable alternative. They might look at doing a different design alternative on that bridge. So yes, I do know that there is quite a bit of back and forth kind of go between on the bridge, what kind of project it should be and what the correct fix should be.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of other questions. Representative Guineas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of criteria, how long do you expect one of these bridges to last as you're funding it? What's the life expectancy?
Mr. Chair, Representative, typically bridges typically last anywhere from 40 to 50 years up to 100 years. I would probably not be the best person to speak about bridge lifespan, but I would be delighted to get more information back to the committee.
Representative Guineas.
That would be helpful as we consider bonding for bridges, because there are some bridges that were built in the 1970s that lasted, 30, 40 years, and some built in 1900 that lasted 100. And it does seem that we should have better expectations than 40 years.
Another question from Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question kind of on the leveraging basis when it comes to the dollars we put forward versus kind of the feds and some things like that. Just kind of wanted to see kind of how that ratio works and is there a maximum that we can, kind of like a employer match to a 401k type of thing, or if you could go down that road, that'd be appreciated. Thank you.
Ms. Heck.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I know that there are significantly more bridges on that list than we can actually fund. I also know that when we get federal funds for the bridge program, we do judiciously, parcel those funds out, and the federal government requires a 20% match. So typically, these funds are used just for the match portion. There are cases where it might be a very large bridge that even the match would be cost prohibitive for the local entity, in which case this program could pay more than just the local match portion. There are some cases where this would pay all of the portion for the bridge if it's not eligible for federal funding, again, depending on which system it's on and the type of bridge. So we do everything we can to kind of stretch these dollars further and try to reserve them for the match portion. There are some cases in which that's not possible.
Ms. Hatch, one more question. Any idea what the total number of bridges is in Minnesota, local bridges?
Mr. Chair, that is a great question, and I might be able to get close here. Mr. Chair, I don't believe I have that information with me, but I'd be happy to do follow up to the committee. And
thank you. If you get that information to the committee, it'd be nice to know what percentage of those bridges I'm driving over is about to collapse. So, no, that's a pun. We do have a quorum right now, so I'm going to call the meeting officially to order. And Representative Erdahl, would you like to move the minutes to the last meeting?
Mr. Chairman, they are very fine minutes, and I do move the approval.
All those in favor signify by saying aye. And opposed by the same sign. Minutes are approved. Ms. Hatch, please go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Again, this slide shows the local bridge bond appropriations we've had in the last couple of years. So in 2013, as you saw on the prior slide, there were $30 million allocated to the department, and that was from general obligation bonds, which funded 94 projects. In 2014, there was a total of $33 million between GO bonds and general fund cash. Again, that funded 51 projects out of the 143 projects that were approved and on the list waiting for funding. This is just an example of some of the bridges that we have funded through this program over the last number of years. So, and they truly are across the state. And again, the type of bridge, the lifespan of the bridge, the cost of the bridge all really is dependent upon the type of bridge that's being built, the size of the bridge, the span of the bridge, other local needs that might be needed on the bridge, et cetera. There have been, apparently the list that we have is, well, there's 1,700 structurally deficient bridges in the state, and again, that is does not mean that the bridges are about to fall down. But there's 800 bridges that have been passed by resolution by the local entities and are on the list to be funded. Total replacement cost for that list would be about $265 million. A similar program that we operate at the Department of Transportation is funding for the local road improvement program. These are grant funds that are granted to the local municipalities that are done through a solicitation process. In 2012, we received an authorization of $10 million. Those funds are completely obligated as of this date. In 2014, we had a total of $54.4 million. Again, split between general obligation bonds and general fund cash. The slide, and I think you have copies of the slide depicts where those remaining funds are going, but they are all essentially committed, just not under contract at this time. But we are working on the design and getting it through the technical process to get the funds moving to the local entity. There is an advisory committee, I should mention, that meets, that selects these projects. As I mentioned, they are granted, they are grant funds, and they are basically can be allocated into three different accounts. The local road improvement program has a trunk highway corridor projects account, which provides funding assistance to local agencies when the local share of the cost of improving the trunk highway impacts a roadway in their community that they need to update or upgrade at the same time. There's a local road account for routes of regional significance, which provides funding assistance to local agencies where their projects are significant to the state or to the region. Such projects may support economic development, provide capacity or congestion relief, provide connections to interregional corridors or other major highways, as well as elimination of hazards. And then there's the local road account for rural road safety, which provides funding for projects in the county state aid highway intended to reduce traffic crashes, deaths, injuries, and damage or property damage.
We have a couple more questions, Ms. Hatch. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I asked to do on this slide, so the timing is really, really good. On here it says the 2014 projects that were prioritized through legislation on here. Does MnDOT look at the state as a whole, independent of the separate MnDOT districts when it makes these priorities, or do you go inside each of the districts and look for that district's priorities and try to provide even funding across the state for those types of projects?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's actually a selection committee that is not based on district. It's a group of local individuals that come together that form this committee that actually do the selection of the projects, and they do it based on a specific criteria depending on which of the three accounts they're looking to fund. Typically, we look for routes of regional significance and rural road safety are the two categories. And so the group comes together, they score the proposals and look at the need and the system as a whole and then make those allocations. So the funds are not necessarily spread out based on district.
Follow-up, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I'll just bring to the committee's attention, and I won't pontificate on it, but with the gas taxes that are raised in the state of Minnesota by each of the MnDOT districts, that's tracked. And then when you look at where those funds go, it's not necessarily staying in those districts or being used in those districts. It's being used on MnDOT's overall plan. And so this is why I've been a big advocate of using bonding to be able to help this as an even, to even out the ebbs and flows across the state of Minnesota. When an area is paying in more in gas tax and maybe not getting the dollars back into their district, and bonding can be a way to be able to help some of that offset.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Runbeck has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask about kind of the same topic. So when when a bridge in a local area has been scheduled for rebuilding, is there a particular share then that the local government, since they were made the resolution to get to do the repair, are they obligated to be involved financially, and to what extent?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't believe that the local road improvement projects necessarily have to go through a resolution process. I know that that the locals, the counties and the cities would need to be aware of it and on board, but it is a different process than we go through for the local bridge program, where they actually have to pass a resolution and go through the kind of engineering study in order to get on the bridge list. But certainly they would put forward the number and the type and the size of the bridges that they like replaced or feel that they have a need to have replaced through the local road improvement program. I can get back to you in terms of the share. I don't know that there's an explicit share for this program. In some cases, we fund the entire project through this program, with the exception of the local project development. In many cases, this would fund only the hard construction elements and not the project development.
Senator Runbeck, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just then to clarify, on the local bridge program, where there is a resolution by the councils and boards, are they then involved financially?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, implicitly, yes, they would be. And again, it depends on the size of the project and the dollar amount. We often would have them bear the burden for some of the project delivery and the preliminary engineering that takes place to get a project ready. And then the actual cost of the construction in the case of the local bridge program. If it's a federally funded project, the federal government would pay 80%, and then the local bridge program would pay the remaining 20% on behalf of the local entity. In some cases, if the bridge is large or too costly for the local entity to cover any portion or even a significant portion of their share, then this program could make up the difference.
All right, thank you.
Representative Hansen has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm still kind of reeling from the reality-based financing. I'm looking forward to that bill coming forward. But my question is on the local road improvement with rights-of-way maintenance. So if you have a local road and the rights-of-way, maybe a background question, Mr. Chair, does MnDOT have ready analysis of rights-of-way ownership when they're doing financing?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, these are projects that are on the local system, and so MnDOT has very little. We don't get really involved at all in the maintenance and operations portion of the project or the sustaining of the project after it's completed. We do provide some technical assistance, certainly, if requested, and in many cases our districts work closely with the counties that exist in their districts to share, in some cases, maintenance equipment, in some cases, other commodities and things like that. But MnDOT does not have a role in the maintenance and operations of the roadway at all, other than there is a construction account in the County State Aid Highway Fund, and they also get funding for operations and maintenance. So other than passing through funding from the County State Aid Highway Fund, and certainly in the local road improvement program, we would have no role with the maintenance.
Representative Hans.
Mr. Chair, and maybe to clarify the question, not having a role in the maintenance, but having, if you're providing the state financing for the local road, does the state have any idea of what the ownership is where they're providing the state funding to it? Do you have, let's just say you have a 10-mile stretch of road that's a local road, but you're providing X million of millions of dollars for redoing that road or making a new road. Are you assuming the counties have or the locals have that information, or do you do some type of check about the ownership of the rights of way?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would have to get back to you on that. I'm sure that in the project development process, as they go through engineering studies, I'm sure that the local entities work closely. I know that they work closely with our state aid office, and I'm not sure who is responsible for doing the land management portions of the documentation, but I'd be happy to find out in terms of who owns the land and especially if they're going to expand the roadway at all, that would impact adjacent landowners. But in most cases, I would expect, especially if they're going to kind of rehabilitate a road or reconstruct a road that's already in existence, that typically the counties would do it within the right-of-way, and in most cases, I believe that they own the right-of-way a little bit on either side of the edge of the road.
And Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, final question, and this is relating to funding, so I'm on projects. For a state road, does MnDOT have ownership mapped on all the rights-of-ways with the state highways?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I couldn't speak to that today, but I'd be happy to get information back to you. I don't know that it's if it's mapped. It may be mapped. I know we have an entire Office of Land Management and folks that do nothing but manage the rights of way and are in contact with adjacent landowners. But I'd be happy to do follow-up and get that back to you.
Thank you, Ms. Hatch. Just to elucidate a little bit, Representative Hansen, I know when the state replaced a bridge adjacent to my farm on a state highway, they had very accurate records of where the ownership lines were, and they needed an easement to utilize some of the property that they didn't own, and so those easements were all put in place before the project started. I don't know if it's on a map, a universal map, but they certainly do have the information. Ms. Hatch, Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, sort of the challenge on this, so like in my district, Robert Street is a state road, Highway 3, but to change that, the sidewalks may not be within the right of way, and you may have businesses that have different pieces. So ownership records of who owns what, you know, and you've got a road that goes from an urban to a suburban, and maybe it was a rural road, and there's changes with ownership. That's part of things get more difficult as you have development that happens. So that's part of the question.
Thank you, Representative. Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So as we see here, there is a little bit of unobligated funding there, essentially the funding we received in 2014. However, it is all committed to projects or programmed to projects. A little bit more information about the local road improvement program. Again, they're grants to counties for rural road safety or for the purposes of statewide or regional significance. There is a solicitation process for project selection that resulted in 135 applications being provided for $291 million of total funding. Applications are currently being reviewed, and in the final selections will be made in March, and then we expect that all of those funds will be committed in the system shortly thereafter. Again, some examples of the projects in the local road improvement program. For Greater Minnesota Transit, we have received a couple of appropriations, appropriation for $6.4 million in 2012, and another appropriation for $1.5 million in 2014. The remaining balance from the 2012 appropriation is being utilized per current law to fill out the remaining funding that is needed for the full project that was provided the balance of the funding in 2014, and that is the St. Cloud Metro Bus Project. The project is eligible to use those remaining funds, and the cost of the project, the total cost of the project, is estimated at $2.1 million, with the St. Cloud Metro Bus providing the $450,000 local match. The project is in preliminary design, and we do expect to have that fully under contract as well this spring.
Ms. Hatch, on these Greater Minnesota Transit projects, what all is eligible for state help? Is it the rolling stock? Is it the garage they keep it in? Can you give us a little more information?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. There's a lot that is eligible, and I can tell you what the priorities are in terms of the funding. They first have a priority to fund vehicles that can actually go out and provide the service. So that is always the first need that is covered if that need, in fact, does exist in a certain area. The second area that they look to is to provide facilities to support vehicles, maintenance operations, or programs. So mechanics, facilities, things like that, as well as vehicle storage. And then finally, kind of the third category that they'll fund is what they refer to as auxiliary procurements, such as additional maintenance equipment, training, and administrative offices for the local provider.
Do you want to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, I was just wanted to note that what I believe the witness is describing is the overall funding available for Greater Minnesota Transit, not just general obligation bonding, because GO bonds cannot be used for rolling stock.
Thank you for that information. Ms. Hatch. Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the slide that was just previously up there, maybe I'm not understanding the vernacular here, but it says that there's $1.1 million for the bus project itself, and that's what the ask was initially. But then it would appear that there's an additional $551,000 that's going to go towards the project. Did they enhance the project? Did they change the project? Or why do they need the additional money?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the $551,000 was unobligated and is not planned to have to be used in the 2012 program, and that was known at the time of the last bond request. And so the total of $1.5 million that was submitted last year as a bond request included the knowledge that the $551,000 was going to be carried forward essentially into the next authorization. So out of the total $1.5 million that was appropriated in 2014, $400,000 was planned to go to Kandy Ohi Area Transit. And then we did plan explicitly for the $1.1 million to be allocated to the St. Cloud project, as well as the remaining balance on the 2012 authorization. So the scope of the project and the cost of the project did not change from what was originally submitted. The actual submission only included the balance that we did not have at the time.
Well, thank you. Please go ahead.
Moving on to a railroad warning device replacement, this is a program that we do hear a lot about these days as freight trains are getting more and more coming through the state. But it is a program that was first appropriated in 2011. It was the first time that state bond funds were used for the program. Most of the rail grade crossings are actually on the county system, and so the county system is where we obviously would use the general obligation bonds. We do provide funding from the Trunk Highway Fund, Trunk Highway Cash, to provide funding for railroad grade crossings that exist on the Trunk Highway system, although there's very few of them compared to the county state aid highway system. Essentially, this funding is used to upgrade antiquated systems. These systems have a useful life of about 20 years, and so at the 20-year mark, they're typically needed to be upgraded or replaced. As they get beyond their useful service life. In 2012, we received $2 million in bond funds, so we completed 13, we have 13 projects underway, seven of them have been completed, and the remainder we expect to be completed this calendar year. The 2014 funding, we received $2 million in GO bonds, and as you can see there, we have a $1.75 million that was committed to Shoreview, and $250,000 to replace the system in Cushing. We are working with other cities and municipalities to define scope and to develop agreements.
Representative Ugham has a question.
Thank you. With regard to the railroad warning device replacement, what role do the railroads play in this? Do they kick in some money on this deal? actually, I guess I'm kind of astounded at the small amounts that are there. Could you comment on that?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is a significant backlog of these projects. In fact, I believe that the number that we really ought to be replacing annually is about 80 of these signals in order to keep up with the number of them that are out there. And then, of course, as traffic gets heavier in certain areas, particularly in rural areas, it becomes a significant safety issue. The commissioner, per Minnesota Statute 219.14 and 219.40, has the responsibility for grade crossing safety. So typically that does fall to the department and to the state to maintain safety on those systems by upgrading these signals or making sure that they're current. However, the railroads do provide some maintenance to the tune of about $3,000 per year per gate, approximately.
So they do
typically provide some operating and some maintenance funding to keep that intersection working.
A follow-up, Representative Wilmoth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, it's our responsible for safety, but where does the liability lie? We had an incident that was pretty well publicized up in Anoka on Highway 47, and long litigation and finally resolved. But where does the liability lie, and do you have any ideas how that could be improved?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not familiar with the liability issues. I do have a colleague with me that might be able to speak to that. Otherwise, I'd be also happy to go back to the department and research some information for you and get you some printed material that would address your question.
That'd be very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We can bring in the cavalry if you'd like, Ms. Hatch, if they're here.
It's completely your decision.
Well, we've got time. Let's. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Gardner. I'm director of the Freight and Rail Office at MnDOT. And to try to address that question, Representative, what we typically do is to actually mix in a certain amount of federal funds along with the state funds. There's been national guidance and regulations that indicate if you go through a federal approval process using federal funds, federally approved warning devices, that provides you and the railroads a measure of protection in terms of liability in the event of incidents. So that we do receive federal funds for grade crossing, new grade crossing systems. Typically, we use those funds to upgrade from passive crossbucks where there's not active protection to an active warning system. So whether it's replacement or an expanded system, if you will, we have that level of protection if we use federal funds.
Representative Ogle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But yet the railroad is doing some maintenance, and I know in the incident that I'm referring to, which you may be familiar with, it boiled down to the railroad maintenance issues on that particular crossing, and it seems to me the liability seems... It seems like there's not a clear path to that, and there's not a clear path to responsibility for this. Do you feel that way?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not an attorney, so I really couldn't speak to the liability issue in that way. The railroads are responsible for maintaining these signal systems. The public sector, generally speaking, provides the capital to put them there in the first place and to replace them, because it's determined that the primary benefit of these systems is for the motorist, not for the railroad per se. So it's the roadway authority that has the responsibility to put these devices in.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rookham.
Well, that seems a little backwards to me. Typically, the railroad is the entity that's going to get sued on something like this. And I would think that the whole railroad warning device system, the cross arms and everything else, should be the responsibility of the railroad. I just don't see how the state ended up with some of that. Is there room for improvement in this?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would think there might be. In every event of an incident, certainly we hear from attorneys, the railroads hear from attorneys,
yeah.
And there's actions that are taken. But the responsibilities in terms of capital investment, maintenance, and to some extent liability are determined by federal regulation.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Ogleham. Ms. Hatch, please continue.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have one more question here. Representative Vogel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure which one of the testifiers, but when I see
quiet zones, it would kind of, I infer from that, that might be improvements that would allow the train to go through without making the whistleblower or something like that. And maybe some improvements that allow that to happen, which are very nice. I'm wondering, though, if something like that is ranked over safety. In other words, there may have been gates or some type of lights or whatever at some of these intersections that might have been upgraded for a quiet zone. But there might be other instances in other areas where there are no lights at all, and therefore the safety issue might be a little more overriding. So just kind of a clarification if my assumptions are right or how that might be done.
Mr. Gardner, I believe.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, we do prioritize safety hazards at all of the 4,500 grade crossings around the state of public roadways. This particular legislation provides for the replacement of systems, so it's not looking at expansion systems, if you will, to upgrade from a passive crossing to an active crossing. And this legislation actually directed specific amounts of funds to particular communities for their project, which involved both safety upgrades, but also with the end result of creating what's called a quiet zone under a federally approved process. So at one level, it's a quality of life project. At another level, there are definitely safety upgrades that are required to achieve that federal approval. In other words, going from two gates to four gates, for example, and other measures that are part of the project.
Representative Volpe.
Mr. Chair and testifiers, so then, being relatively new at this, would it be the discretion of those of us that would be making the decision for this funding to maybe move more of it toward actual what might be, I'd consider, primary safety improvements rather than these type of things? Not that these aren't important, but I'm just curious about the discretion and who makes those decisions.
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it's the legislature that ultimately decides how those funds should be directed, whether it's in a general fashion or specific to particular communities or types of projects. Absolutely.
Representative Pawlowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gardner, I'd like you to explain how a quiet zone is established. How exactly and what level of government is primarily responsible? And then once you've done that, I'd like a breakdown of how it's paid for.
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, quiet zones are approved and implemented through a federal process. The applicant is actually the local road authority. The state typically doesn't have a role other than as a technical advisor. In all instances of grade crossing safety upgrades, what's called the diagnostic team works together, which includes the Federal Railroad Administration, the local road authority, MnDOT, in some cases, the railroads themselves, to determine what that upgrade should be precisely. And then for a quiet zone specifically, those are the funding responsibility of the local road jurisdiction. We don't have a program currently normally for that type of a project. In this instance, there was specific legislation to achieve that goal.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gardner, I appreciate that. Now, I want to tie a number to this. You say the local road authority. If it's the city, then the city would be responsible for the payment of the quiet zone. And there's a, it's not in my district, but it's adjacent to mine. I found out 2 weeks ago that could be $300,000. So, Mr. Gardner, if the city doesn't want to pay for it, I wonder where they'd go.
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I suppose they would go where the money is. And that could be at the state level. It could be potentially at the federal level, although there's not a specific federal program for quiet zones at this time.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gardner, and I'm not holding you responsible for this, but this is a considerable sum of money, $300,000. And it would be raised, if it's a local entity, through property taxes. It's certainly, there's no fee that I can imagine that could be assessed. So you're looking for a quiet zone for safety reasons and other reasons, particularly if you have schools, hospitals, nursing homes that are along that railroad track, and in our area you do. As these trains begin to multiply, and you've already heard the discussion of it, and they're multiplying fast in greater Minnesota, quiet zones and safeties are a huge issue, and it would appear now a big expense. So if the local entity can't handle it, they're going to end up here, and this could rapidly be real money. You don't need to comment on it. That's my comment, but I appreciate the detail of your answer. It helps a great deal. Thank you.
Representative Pawlowski, is real money defined in statute?
Mr. Chair, real money to me is when you get up to $300,000 and the primary responsibility is the local entity, and it has to be raised by property taxes, which is the most regressive tax we had. They're already too high, and now we're adding this, and it's purely for safety. I consider a quiet zone as a safety issue too, particularly when you're butting right up to a school, when you have nursing homes on either side. You have issues here where this is a safety issue also. So that's real money to me.
Thank you, Representative. We have another question from Representative Hausman.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair, to take MnDOT off the hook, because they really had no part in that decision. This is, and maybe Representative Runbeck knows a little more about this. This was an issue you probably read about in the newspapers. And it's triggered by this massive amount of increase in rail traffic in multiple northern suburban neighborhoods, and I don't know if any of that was nearest yours. It was in yours, brought by Representative Isaacson. But it rose to the level of news stories in the paper. The nature of those neighborhoods, the multi-jurisdictional nature of it, and an unusual circumstance because of the volume of rail traffic. So it was sort of an exception to the rule rather than any regular program you have. I think that so they don't need to defend that one. I probably need to defend that one.
We'll accept that as a comment, Representative. Ms. Hatch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So moving on to the Port Development Assistance Program, this program is funded with general obligation bonds. In 2012, the program received $1 million in bond authority, and all of that bond authority has been obligated to date. In 2014, this program also received $2 million in bond authority, and that bond authority is set aside essentially for four projects, and all of that funding should be obligated here shortly. They're all slated for 2015 construction, and the specific projects you'll see noted at the very bottom of this slide, Duluth, St. Paul, Winona, and Red Wing, a project in each of those ports. Since 1998, the legislature has invested $25 million in this program, which has benefited 34 projects. Just by way of background, this program supports infrastructure needs of the Minnesota public ports on the Great Lakes and inland river navigation systems that improve freight handling and efficiency. These are typically state grants that fund 80% of the project, with 20% needing to come from the local entity. This is a partnership program with MnDOT and the port authorities. Proposals are prioritized based on need, employment, and the overall expected generated economic benefits. Examples of projects might include sheet piling, rehabbing buildings, rehabbing dock walls, stormwater management, and dockside improvements. In 2014, we were also funded for a couple of airport projects. These were originally local requests that came to the legislature, were funded through MnDOT. So in 2014, we were authorized for $7.2 million, and of that funding, all but $2.9 million is currently under contract. The remainder is expected to be under contract very shortly. They are the Range Regional Airport, which is in Hibbing, which is $5 million is allocated to that project. Site work is underway and steel is being erected. There is a small remaining balance, $700,000, committed in the future to fund some smaller elements of the project. There's also the Falls International Airport in International Falls. Received $2.2 million through that grant for design, construction, and to furnish and equip a new terminal building at the airport. This project is currently in the design phase, and as soon as it's completed and through the authorization process, that remaining $2.2 million will be encumbered. The next program is the Safe Routes to Schools program. This is a general obligation bonding program that provides infrastructure support to support safe walking and bicycling to school. We do it through education, enforcement, and infrastructure, primarily education and enforcement on the non-capital side of that equation. The benefits are reduced congestion around the schools, reducing school transportation costs by reducing busing, provides opportunities for physical activity for the students. We also received some flood funding in 2012. Some of that was trunk highway bonds, and some of that was general obligation bond funding. As you recall, this was the significant flood that occurred up in the Duluth area. Of this total funding, you'll see in the trunk highway section, $18 million is still unobligated. That funding is set aside for the Jay Cook State Park roadway, and that work we expect to have encumbered. We're shooting for March of 2015. The general obligation bond authority for the cities and counties is typically used to pay the local share of the portion that is eligible for Federal Highway Administration emergency relief funding, not FEMA funding, but the FHWAER funding, and this typically pays the local share of that funding. We also have some trunk highway facilities, some buildings that have been under construction, and we have an appropriation from 2012 where we received $17.6 million. We also received trunk highway cash of $17.5 million. And we received trunk highway cash appropriation in 2014 for $7.95 million. I realize typically we talk about bonding in the capital investment arena. However, as you know, bonding and cash, it's a different financing mechanism, but all of these are capital projects for which we were seeking authority from the legislature to embark on those projects. The funding was spent on these three projects, essentially. We built a Rochester headquarters. We built a new facility. The previous year, we received an authorization to build a new maintenance facility. And then this funding was used to remodel the headquarters, to move the lab, the materials lab, to another location in the building, et cetera. All of those funds are expected to be expended on that project. We expect the project will be completed in total by the end of this calendar year. We also have the Wilmer District Headquarters. There were some enlargement of the maintenance facility at the maintenance district headquarters, as well as some remodeling of that facility as well. And then the Plymouth Truck Station here in the Twin Cities. That was a complete rebuild of that facility. We also have the Cambridge Truck Station. $3.3 million went to the Cambridge Truck Station. Again, a complete rebuild of that truck station. We also funded design fees for Crookston, Eden Prairie, and our Mendota facilities. Those are design fees to go and do the preliminary engineering to get plans designed for which we would come back at a future date and seek funding to actually do the construction on those projects. And then we also have, from 2014, $3.58 million for the Little Falls Truck Station. We received Trunk Highway Bond Authority for a Quarters of Commerce program. The Quarters of Commerce program, you may be familiar with, is to improve the commerce of the state through the construction, reconstruction, and improvement of the state highway system. It primarily has two benefits listed in statute, and that is capacity development, and that is for both Greater Minnesota as well as the Metro, and improved freight movement. We received two bond authorizations. One was the larger bond authorization of $300 million. We have all but $162.9 million of that under contract today, and I know the solicitation took place this past fall for the remaining portion of that, and it's those projects are programmed, just not under contract completely yet. We also have trunk highway cash that was appropriated to us of $31.5 million from the legislature in 2014. I wanted to take a moment, if I could, to just cover some of the Trunk Highway debt service with you, just to sort of wrap up the remaining portion here of my presentation. And again, I'm happy to take questions. Minnesota Statute 167.60 required us to develop a debt management policy for the Trunk Highway Fund. That policy, which has been in place now for several years, states that MnDOT cannot exceed 20% of the state revenues to the Trunk Highway Fund in terms of a debt payment, an annual debt payment. As you probably are aware, we make that debt payment just before December 1st every year, and we watch the fund very closely to make sure that we don't exceed the 20% of the Trunk Highway Fund state revenues to the fund. If we were to approach that, and certainly if we were to exceed that, the policy requires that we notify you at the time or as soon as we realize that we would violate that policy.
We have a question from Representative Rublin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to Corridors of Commerce, you mentioned that most of that money had been let and everything else. Where's the 610 project in that? Is that all set to go and all the monies have been appropriated?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. All of those funds have been, through the solicitation process, all of those projects have been selected, and all of that is programmed. So I know the 610 project is programmed. I couldn't tell you today exactly where it is in the paperwork process to get the funds encumbered, but those funds are set aside for the 610 program.
Oh, thank you. Very important to my district. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. We have another question from Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to be clear, none of the Corridors of Commerce money was in a bonding bill, since we're the Capital Investment Committee. That all happened in the transportation funding bill.
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. The Corridors of Commerce funding happened in the not in the Capital Investment bill, not in the bonding bill.
I have a question. So the cash portion of that, how does that relate to the bonds, or is it just completely separate?
Mr. Chair, the cash portion, in this case, it's just another portion of funding for that overall program that was initiated with trunk highway bonds. And actually, typically, the Trunk Highway Bonding Authority often will go through the Trunk Highway Appropriations process. It often does come to this committee for your awareness, but it typically passes in the Highway Appropriations Bill. In this case, I'm listing it here just to show you the complete package in the program. The $300 million was the only bond authority we received, however.
Thank you. We have another question from Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, as I look at the debt management policy, the grid showing the years, what amount of debt are we retiring every year?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have that information with me today, but I'd be happy to get that back to you. We do retire debt. The bulk of our debt, however, is in front of us rather than behind us. So we are we have not retired very much, if any, complete bonds at this point. We essentially had no bonding in the Trunk Highway Fund prior to the Bond Accelerated Program, which took place in the early 2000s. And since then, our bond use has increased pretty steadily. And we are, in fact, two forecasts ago, we were very close to approaching that 20% debt limit in the Trunk Highway Fund. So we do pay debt service every year. We front-load the bonds. They're all 20-year bonds. In the first 5 years of the bond, we typically pay 40% of the total bond issue. We've had really good interest rates, so we've received really good premium on our bonds for the last number of years, since about 2008. And so we've done pretty well in terms of being able to stay above water on the debt. But it is something that we watch very closely. I will show you a slide here towards the end that displays the total amount of trunk highway bonds that are outstanding, and that may or may not answer your question, but I can get back to you in terms of the proportion of the debt that we've retired, but it would not be very much compared to the amount that we are just now selling.
Senator Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that would be helpful to, you know, just kind of visually appreciate the amount of debt that, you know, is before us, and kind of the schedule of retirement that that might be very helpful as we consider options for our transportation policy.
Thank you. Ms. Hatch. I'm sorry. We have another question from Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just feeling the need, I think, to always clarify this policy would be Transportation Committee policy. Isn't that correct? I mean, that this 20%, that's a transportation Transportation Committee established process, separate from GO bonding and this committee. Isn't that correct?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. To the extent that if you don't appropriate or don't authorize trunk highway bonding, then it would probably be less than your purview, although it still might be important to know if we come with, we typically have, like I said, bond authorizations that we request for facilities and things like that. And at some portion in the legislative process, they do typically get moved out of the bonding bill, but to the extent that they might pass through this committee.
Mr. Chair, I understand the where some of those projects are, but I mean, so that we're not misled, mm-hmm. were we to change this policy in here, I'm guessing Representative Kelly might pull the bill into his committee because we would have just changed a transportation policy.
We're getting nods of agreement to Representative Hausman. Thank you for pointing that out. Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, the next slide you'll see there just basically shows where we are relative to our policy that based on year, for example, if you look at 2017, in 2017 we expect to pay $225.2 million in our annual debt service payment. That represents about 17.5% against the 20% of our policy limit. And essentially, the $32.6 million there in the far right column indicates the amount of additional debt service that would get us up to the 20%. Not that I would advocate that we'd be at the 20%. So a rough estimate, a good rule of thumb, is additional bond capacity in the Trunk Highway Fund is about $300 million. This slide just shows the debt service projections and the amounts that we have paid and anticipate that we'll have coming in the coming years. Again, in 2015, we expect to pay $154.6 million in the debt service. This next chart here, it might be hard for you to read, and we can provide it in a larger format if you like, but this is essentially all of the outstanding bond authorizations that we have at the Department of Transportation. And finally, this last slide shows the amount of trunk highway bonds that have been issued. We have we have authorizations of $2.829 billion that have been approved by the legislature. Of that total, we have sold, and most of that was recent selling from the Chapter 152 bonds. We have sold just over $2 billion of that $2.8 billion authorizations. And we have about $737 million left to sell. We do cash flows on these projects, and we only sell the bonds at the time that we'll, for the window of time that we'll need the actual cash to repay on the projects.
Thank you, Ms. Hatch. A question from Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hatch, the transport, the TED funds, the TED bonds for roads, are they a different category? Are they authorized then by deed, is it, or, and do they have their own cap on the amount of debt that they can carry?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe some of the TED bonds were trunk highway bonds. Some of that was trunk highway cash, and we have requested some general obligation bonds. If they're GO bonds, those would not count against our trunk highway policy. That would count against, obviously, the state's guidelines, debt guidelines, but it would not impact the trunk highway policy, nor would the trunk highway cash appropriations that have gone to that program. But the trunk highway bonds definitely would count against the policy.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hatch, if you go back to your debt management policy slide, and I'm just looking at, I don't know if I'm not understanding it, but there seems to be an anomaly between the variance from the 20% policy limit in years between 2015 and 2016 even though the debt service is growing substantially. Could you explain the, what I'm not understanding? Why it goes from 81.3 to 48.1?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that that's the 81.3 represents the available funding, the available debt service amount we could take on in order to get to the 20%. So, for example, if you go one column to the left, at $81.3 million between where we are and where the cap is, we're only at 13.4% out of the 20%. However, when we sold additional bonds and in the next year we're up to 16.1% out of the 20%, that decreased the overall amount of debt we could take on in order to get up to the cap. So the third column represents the variance from current forecast up to the 20% limit. So how much more in actual debt service payment would be needed in order to get us up to the 20%.
Are you catching that, Representative Walbright? As the third column near zero, we get more and more nervous.
So do I, Mr. Chair. So just maybe to bring in your bottom statement about we could afford an estimated $300 million in bonding without violating the debt policy. Mm-hmm. How does that square with the chart is only relevant to the debt service, and the statement at the bottom is an extrapolation of the total value of the bonds, correct?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. Okay. Essentially, to derive the $300 million, and I'm using a kind of a rough rule of thumb here, but we would always look for our high year, which would be fiscal year 2017, is the highest percentage that we have towards the 20% limit. And then if you go a column to the right, that $32.6 million at 5% interest rates, basically, it's a factor of 10 is a rough estimate. Now, of course, when we actually would, have a proposal for bonds, we would do a full cash flow analysis. So essentially, at a 5% interest rate, and interest rates for the last several years have been well below 5%, but at a 5% interest rate, it's roughly a factor of 10 to estimate the amount of debt load that we could take on and still be at or underneath the cap.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Hatch. Question from Mr. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the, you had mentioned that the bonds are generally selling at a premium, and if that's the case, then we're paying a slightly higher rate than market when we issue the bonds to get the premium on them. So does that impede us going forward because we could have issued those bonds at a lesser price or a lesser rate relative to getting just par?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, essentially we make it up. We get the premium in the front end, and then we pay the remainder in the back end of it. We have the benefit, however, on the trunk highway side that we're able to apply the difference, the savings, to our current year's debt payment. So we essentially get a lot of savings in the first year that we get the premium, whereas the general fund does not have the luxury to do that. I don't know if that answers your question.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vogel.
Well, I guess simplistically looking at it, I'd say if we're issuing it at a slightly higher, the bond at a slightly higher rate because we're being able to sell it as a premium, then we're going to have to pay that higher rate for the entire 20-year period. So we will look better at the beginning, but then as we look at these cash flows going forward, it kind of puts us behind, was my question, as we go out into later years, because now we're saddled with a higher rate than we could have had.
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's essentially correct, although we do refinance the bonds anytime we have the opportunity. So we do watch it, and we do refinance the bonds as often as we can to make sure we're constantly taking advantage of those lower interest rates. And for the foreseeable future, the projections right now are through fiscal year 17 for them to be well below 5%.
Thank you. Any other? I see no other. I do see another question from Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Hatch, based upon that last statement, then, mm-hmm. with the refinancing of bonds and the premium, because one way or the other, we're paying for it, whether you refinance it through other means. But so given the current state of interest rates on 20-year bonds, how often are we looking at refinancing them, and are we currently actively looking at that proposition?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, current, as of this fiscal year, yes. I mean, we look at them every time we approach a bond sale. We do look at what would be the benefit of refinancing. This past year, we did refinance. I wouldn't be able to pull off the top of my head the number, but I could certainly get it to you. Of the bonds that we did refinance, and we saved about $1.5 million by doing that. We do, every time we go out to sell bonds, we do look at the benefit of refinancing. We don't have a bond sale planned, I think, until August, so it's not something that I am entertaining these days, but we definitely keep an eye on it.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hatch, are any of the bonds that we issue for trunk highway bonds callable?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe so. I don't believe so.
Very good. I believe that we have run out of questions. Thank you for your presentation, Ms. Hatch. If anyone has questions in the future, they certainly can get a hold of her using the contact information in her presentation. You know, I like to point out important guests in the audience, and we do have a former representative hiding back in the corner. Mike Beard is with us today, waving. I would also like to point out that next Tuesday we should have a very interesting hearing. We're going to be hearing about the Lewis and Clark pipeline project. We have representatives coming from the project, the overall project that is an interstate project, so we'll be looking at that. And we've invited the Senate to join us, so it'll be a joint hearing looking at the details of what happened last year and hopefully get some idea of where the federal government is in relationship to reimbursing the state of Minnesota. With that, today's meeting is adjourned.